This audio interview with Brian Furness is part of the ANU Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program, involving retired staff members who were part of the ANU in its earlier years. The program was initiated and developed by Emeritus Faculty as a contribution to university and community understanding of the beginnings and development of the ANU over the past 50 years or so. Emeritus Faculty has a special interest in this period, since the faculty's membership includes many of the people who helped shape ANU in those early days to make it the preeminent university it is today. Brian Furness was appointed Foundation Director of the ANU Medical Service in 1966, a position he held until his retirement in 1991. He trained at Oxford University Medical School and was a medical registrar and research assistant in Middlesex Hospital Medical School in London. After emigrating with his wife and twin daughters to Australia, he worked in medical practices in Goulburn and Canberra, from where he was recruited to the ANU Health Service. Brian is known for his imaginative approaches to community medicine, emphasising individual responsibility for healthcare and encouraging the concept of health rather than illth, of prevention over cure. Brian speaks and writes widely about these aspects of community and individual health and well-being. Since retirement, Brian has continued to voice his concerns for environmental sustainability and health issues at local and global levels. His interests range across modes of human burial to the causes and consequences of global climate change. He is an active member of the Nature and Science Forum, Doctors for the Environment, the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, and is a member of the Strategic Council of the Climate Institute of Australia. In 1994, he was appointed a member of the Order of Australia for services to health education and promotion. Well, thank you, Brian, for coming along and helping us with this interview to Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program. Maybe I could start by asking you about your origins, in the sense of who were your mother and father and who else was in your family, and what happened, just briefly, in your early school days.
Sure. I was born and bred in Manchester, in the grim northwest of England, and my parents were teachers. My father was a teacher of deaf children. I was born at home. They lived in a house attached to a junior deaf school, which was a bit of an institutional place to be born into. A few hours before I was born, my mother was very keen on the theatre, and unbeknown to my father, she hopped onto a tram, went into Manchester to see a play. She was very heavy with me, and a very nice gentleman in the gardens where she went said, "Would you like a seat, miss?" That sort of impressed her a bit. I suppose that accounts for the fact that I have been interested in the theatre ever since, and she was very interested in the theatre. But I had quite a difficult delivery at home. The GP and his assistant were involved, and I was sort of thrown into the corner as an afterthought because they were worried about my mother. But I did survive and was brought up duly in this house. My first memories, I suppose, were before school, and it was I remember Manchester being a very grimy city. We had these very thick fogs. It was quite exciting for a boy to go out of the house and get lost in the fog. But both my parents were extremely kind and good, and they put very great store in ethics. Both of them were very ethical people.
Were they educated teachers in the sense of had they been to university or anything?
Yes,
like
they'd
that?
Yes, they'd been. My mother had been to what was called Bangor Normal College in North Wales, where she got her teaching certificate, and my father had done similarly in Manchester, and then qualified also as a teacher of the deaf, a very exacting thing to get involved with. Both of them were on extremely modest incomes. We had the house to live in, but otherwise we didn't have an independent house to live in.
Were there books around in your home when you were a youngster, Brian?
All the time, yes. They took the Manchester Guardian, which I'm still fond of, reading the Guardian weekly and writing letters to it and so on. Manchester was a very liberal place in those days. It had a good library, a good school that I went to. I went to a primary school within walking distance of home. None of this dropped off by car. I used to tricycle to my school, which was about a couple of miles away.
Good heavens, that's
it. And it was a good little school, an old-fashioned primary school. I went there until my mother decided I should, instead of going to the local grammar school, she wanted me to go to Manchester Grammar School, which had a very good academic reputation. In order to do that, I had to settle down to some work, because the only way I could go there was to get a scholarship. And so I managed eventually to see the light, and she got a tutor to me to stop my very untidy ways of writing and so on. That struck a magic chord, and I suddenly was turned on to the idea that learning was quite an interesting business.
And you were born in 1927.
Yes.
So that was just a few years before the General Depression.
Depression, yes. I have memories of people, you know, these poor old boys coming to the house looking for a meal, for example.
Youngsters, you mean?
No, middle-aged.
Middle-aged
men who were out of work. And there was a general air of depression. We lived on near the edge of an industrial site at Trafford Park. The good thing was that we were within walking distance of Old Trafford Cricket Ground, so I used to go and watch Lancashire play, Yorkshire and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Fortunately, we, living in an institution as it were, we had enough food provided, so we didn't really feel the bite of the depression.
Now, when you were about 10 or 11, you then went to what I presume was effectively secondary school, which was Manchester Grammar School.
Yes, they had a prep school, what they call a prep school in Sale, which I was able to go to by train. There was an electric train service there. They had a very eclectic approach to education. I mean, I learnt some... they had languages, Latin, French, as well as English, history, maths, the usual thing, physics. And the only thing I really failed at was woodwork. We were supposed to have a woodwork class.
I see.
But some of the teachers there had been to Manchester Grammar School, and there was quite a nice feeling about it. And from there I had to take a scholarship, what's called a foundation scholarship to MGS, and fortunately got one at the age of 11 plus. Next thing that happened, of course, the war broke out.
Yes.
I can remember quite clearly Neville Chamberlain's speech about Britain being at war with Germany.
Listening to it on the radio.
Listening to it on the radio, and it had a very strong imprint in my mind. I was 12 at the time, but I thought something was amiss. We'd all been issued with gas masks, and tape was put over the windows. But it was decided that the school itself was very vulnerable to bombing, and so it was evacuated to Cheshire, to an old manor house in Cheshire, where some of the rooms were converted to dormitories for the children, and we had one single room to live in. This started, I suppose, the happiest time of my life, in spite of the fact of bombing. My father used to have to commute every weekend to the school where he was teaching, and we came back at weekends. And
so the whole family went to Cheshire?
The whole family, yes. I have a sister, a younger sister.
I see.
In this old manor house, and accommodation was very sparse, and my mother managed to persuade the local farmer to convert a hayloft over the cowshed for my bedroom, and I painted it up and painted the beams, a bit like this restoration man on television. I got used to the rattling of chains. I gave up rugby football because it was difficult. I couldn't play at weekends, and I think rugby football really is a sort of mud bath in England. You're just slithering around in the mud. And I suddenly took up gardening. The Dig for Victory campaign.
Yes.
So I converted a couple of herbaceous borders near the manor house into a vegetable garden, and actually won the local silver cup for gardening when I was 16, growing vegetables, and it was so much, I really enjoyed contact with the soil.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I had a sister, yes.
And she was there with you?
She was there at the manor house, and she lived in a... The manor house, he'd been the master of the Cheshire Hounds, so there were a number of stables. One of the stables was converted for her bedroom, which is rather pleasant. And the kennels that were used for the hounds, my mother converted into a hen house. So we had chooks. She even went into incubators. So we were able to be self-sustaining in food, which was very satisfying. And I've never lost that love of the soil.
Yes.
As my father said when I won this silver cup, he said, I wasn't doing so well at school and I was minding my P's in Middlewich and forgetting my Q's in Manchester. He was quite a wit. But I did manage to actually enjoy school. And
yes.
Not many people do enjoy school, but I think MGS had the highest record of Oxford and Cambridge scholarships of all schools in England, including Eton and Harrow and so on.
Right.
And the teachers there actually were attracted to the school because of its academic record. Salaries weren't as good as some of the bigger public schools, but they were pleased with the record of MGS, which has existed since the 16th century.
Is it?
And
you call it MTS?
MGS, sorry.
Manchester Grammar School.
And I did have an eclectic education in the first 2 years. I still did Latin, French, German, even though we were at war, and history, which was my second favourite subject in English literature. And I think I owe a great deal to my rather eclectic view of life to my grammar school.
Yes. What about science?
I loved science.
Yes.
The last 3 years, I took my matric at 14 and my first go at high school certificate at 16, doing botany, zoology, chemistry and physics. Not many boys, it was an all-boys school, and not many all-boys schools had biology. But MGS had a very good reputation in biology. And in the sixth form, in the they had I had 2 years to do my high school certificate, which I got when I was 16, and then I had another year, a so-called scholarship year, and there were only about six of us in the class. So it was incredible. We had, very personal...
So this scholarship year was added on to your secondary schooling?
Yes.
Was it? Yes, and before you went to university.
Yes, and, yes. I applied...
This was to brush you up and make you shine.
That's right.
Yes.
And it was a very good system for MGS, because some of the people who wanted to go on to university would have a better opportunity of getting scholarships.
Now, perhaps I'm wrong, but for the listener here, the grammar school system was part of the state school system.
Well, Manchester Grammar School was unusual in that it was called the direct grant school. It had a grant from the government and also relied a lot on foundation funds. So it was a mixture of private and public.
I see. Did you pay fees, for example, or your parents pay fees?
Well, having won a scholarship there, I didn't have to pay anything,
right,
except for uniform and so on, which was very good because they didn't have much money. It was a lot of quite bright people. There was a strong Jewish community in Canberra, and a lot of them were very bright, and they did well at the school as well.
Right.
My mother always wanted to me to go to Oxford because her father was an industrial chemist. He lived in Manchester. He used to do experiments in the bathroom, and once or twice there were explosions. He was so impressed by somebody, an American chap, because he was so impressed that he offered him a job in America, and he went over there. Suddenly realised that he'd be taking over from a man who had three children and who would lose the job. And he said, no, I can't take that. And this one of the examples of the ethical,
yes,
very stupid but very ethical,
yes,
behaviour. And he eventually died at the young age of his late 40s or 50s from kidney disease, which I imagine he got from handling, working with dye stuffs. They're very toxic to the kidney.
What drew you then into medicine?
Well, it was when I'd finished at Middlewich in this country place, I was on the horns of a dilemma because I got very interested in horticulture. I used to work for the local farmer, and I was tossing up between taking up a career of farming or medicine because I loved the biological side of my education. And we didn't have any money, so farming was out. So I thought, well, medicine, I'd like to do medicine because I like people. This seemed to be the option that I would choose. I wasn't bright enough to be a scientist.
But you would have had to be very bright to get entry to...
Well, it was certainly for competitive, yes. I suppose. And I got a scholarship, a county scholarship, and I got entry to Merton College, which was the oldest college in Oxford. And I really appreciated that. There were only about 5 medical students in the college. And that's the beauty of the collegiate system. You weren't supposed to talk shop at dinner table. You talked about anything else except shop. I was very taken by the history of the place. It had the oldest library in England and a wonderful chapel.
What did it date from, Merton College?
1226.
13th century, yes. Yeah.
And at that time, it was very post-war strict rationing. And the domestic bursar was also in charge of electricity in Oxford town, and he restricted us to one single bar of electricity for the rooms, and I was in this old medieval stone room, and we used to have to go around in duffel coats, and in the snow you had to tramp over the courtyard to the showers. We had quite strict rationing. I remember a typical dinner would be figs and whale steak, that sort of thing. So
yes.
It was really Spartan.
And as well, your university medical school years coincided with just the end of the war.
And just the end of the war. Right.
Into that period of privation to some extent of
right.
Social economic privation.
What I wanted to do, I'd enlisted in the Navy. You had to do national service in those days of 2 years, and I'd rather fancied myself going to the Navy. My mother said, no, you mustn't do that because you'll stop learning. I know you just stop working unless you keep on the treadmill. And so she interceded with the high master of my grammar school and took him a dozen eggs, which in those days was more bribery and corruption. He said, yes, well, you're in a reserved occupation medicine. And so I went to Merton. About 3/4 of the students there were ex-servicemen, of course, and so I was very green about the gills, aged 18. Looking back, I feel deprived of not going into the Navy. Because I'd been to an all boys grammar school and to all boys college, I felt I was really somewhat deprived of contact with the opposite sex.
Yes, yes. But how? I mean, that's not. You wouldn't have got that through the Navy, would you?
No, but I've been able to wander around.
You would have, yes. But go in every port, is it?
So eventually, I did my national service and. I'd met my wife.
How did you do your national service?
Well, that was after I qualified in medicine.
I see.
The next part of the story, really. At Oxford, I used to row for the college, played a little bit of rugby, rather bad, and swam for the university. And the pattern of university life, traditionally in Oxford, was that lectures were avoided in the afternoons, and people were encouraged to play sport.
Yes.
And you did your work in the library in the evening and so on. And I think it was a very good balance. And that certainly influenced my attitude to the job that I took on here, that all work and no play made Jack a dull boy.
Yes.
A mixture of exercise and study is a very good way of developing the brain. And I think that's been vindicated recently.
And it's part of your philosophy.
Part of my philosophy,
yes.
You know, the old mens sano in corpore sano, the healthy mind and a healthy body.
Yes.
I don't think you can separate the Cartesian idea of mind and body is a false dichotomy.
Yes, but I would just add for the listener that it struck me that while you were at ANU and running the medical facility here, that was a view that you passed on strongly to your students, that exercise was very important to the natural and balanced development of their lives.
Right. If I could interject here, I think I was running a health service, not a medical service.
Sorry.
And there is a fundamental difference in that existing medicine is about diagnosis and treatment of disease, and I was much more interested in the promotion of health.
Yes.
Which you can't do in private practice, there's no money in it. And that's why appointment at the ANU offered that.
Yes.
That's perhaps jumping ahead of me.
Yes, okay. Let's go back to your finishing at medical school, and you then had a series, you worked in the Middlesex Hospital.
Yes, I decided at the end of, I did my preclinical, it was then, medicine was divided into the preclinical and clinical. And I did my preclinical work at Oxford, including an honours degree in physiology. This is where a link with the ANU comes in, because my professor of pathology was Howard Florey, and the reader in physiology was Colin Curtis. The reader in biochemistry was Sandy Oxton. Mm-hmm. So I felt I came to the ANU, at least I had some links with the past.
Yes, yes, that's a fabulous link that you've got with the
university. It was, yes,
and university.
I developed it later on.
Yes.
But I remember when Florey was Chancellor, he came up and looked at the health service, and I asked him whether he thought that penicillin had been a useful drug. And he said, yes, he thought he had been quite useful, but he wished doctors wouldn't give it for sore throats. Now, that was a prophetic statement, because we're now faced with multiple resistant organisms. There's a recent outbreak in Australia of gonorrhea, and they run out of supplies of penicillin.
Mm.
Now, that's outrageous. The man who found us penicillin was an Australian, and they've actually run out of it, and I think that's disgraceful. But I think that was a prophetic statement of Flores. The present professor of microbiology at the hospital says that we may be heading for a pre-Florey era of infectious disease.
You then completed with your honours year in physiology.
Yes, and then did a part-time, it was two terms in pathology and microbiology at Oxford, and then I had to decide what to do for my clinical work. And I thought at that stage the Radcliffe Infirmary in Oxford was not one of the highest known teaching hospitals, and I thought, well, why not leave the flesh pots of Oxford and go to London? I managed to get a scholarship to the Middlesex Hospital, which was, I thought, very pleasant, right in the centre of London, near Oxford Circus. That's where I did my clinical training, and also met my wife, who was a nurse. One of the reasons I went there is they had a lovely bowl of flowers in the front hall, and it had a very civilised sort of air about it, and it was fairly modern in those days. I think there was an Australian connection there. It was Sir Charles Dodds, who was Professor of Biochemistry, who'd been in Melbourne, and a fairly famous sort of family. And biochemistry was my favourite subject at Oxford, and continued since then, I think. But the clinical work was quite interesting. In those days, we really were on call 24 hours a day. I had to get up at all hours and serve in casualty duty and so on. I think we were paid about £20 a week or something. Mm. But we did get our food and free beer at dinner. And one of my experiences on casualty then influenced my opinion later in life. I was there during the Great London Smog of 1951, I think it was, when about 3,000 people died over the weekend. And there's nothing medicine can do about it. The only thing we could do is to send people on the tube to Harrow-on-the-Hill, which was above the smog, or into one of the few air-conditioned cinemas, because the hospital wasn't air-conditioned in those days, and a lot of these old dears already were compromised with respiration, and if you gave them pure oxygen, they'd die, because that would remove their main stimulus, the breathing, which was anoxia. On the neurology wards, I worked on the cardiology ward for one of them, and the other was a neurology ward, where I met my wife, who was a nurse there. I was a bit stunned by her. One of the things I remember, which she doesn't remember, and it was useful, in those days it was common for nurses to be the sort of handmaiden of the doctor and run down and bring his results. And I said, look, I'm sorry, these x-rays aren't ready for the consultant, but would you mind hopping down and getting them from the department? And she looked up with innocent eyes and said, why don't you get them yourself? Oh dear,
yes,
I can't ignore. So then at the end of that period, I had to do my national service. Both of us were interested in skiing, so I thought, well, the army probably rather than the navy. So I put my name down to go to Germany or Austria, and typical army fashion, they sent me to West Africa. So I spent 18 months in Sierra Leone, right up in the bush.
Oh, the hot and wet and...
Oh, sticky, yes. And it was very nice people. This was long before the troubles in Sierra Leone, and I learnt a bit of tropical medicine there.
Was Sierra Leone a British
colony
yeah. then? Yes.
Yeah. That was where, in Freetown, Graham Greene wrote his novel, The Heart of the Matter. And they had a train that came up twice a week from Freetown. There was a little poem, I remember, because the train often ran out of fuel, and so the engine driver had to hop out and chop down some trees and put it in there. And there was a little poem about it. The train for bow, she no agree for go. The engine, she doesn't tire for lack of plenty fire. Train for bow, she no agree for go. And that was on the way to Daru, which was the camp for recruits. I was a sort of medical officer there looking after there.
So you were part of the army at that point?
Part of the army.
Yes, yes.
And there were only three other blokes in the mess, and so it was, there were a few officers had their wives and lived outside, but it was quite a good training in a completely different way of life.
Sort of, and a different sort of medicine.
Different sort of medicine. Yeah. A lot of it was concerned with treating infectious diseases. And I learnt one or two things about it, and that in terms of cross disciplines, I used to go and work with a surgeon in the local town, and he observed that schistosomiasis was very common, in which you pass blood in the urine. And he noticed that schistosomiasis was very common in these low-lying areas, but in the up-lying areas it was not. And the key was that in higher areas, snails couldn't live. And schistosomiasis is transmitted by snails.
So yes.
That was quite an interesting observation. And malaria, of course, was very rife. And in Sierra Leone, they had a condition called sickle cell anemia, which was actually protected people against malaria. So I had to take slides of this. Being general in charge of camp hygiene and so on, but didn't have all that much to do. And my one time of the week I enjoyed was when the train arrived with my wife's letters.
Right, yes.
It was the one contact with sanity, really.
So that brings us through to you in your late 20s, at which point you went back into London to the Chest Hospital. I guess your experience there was...
I was still on the debating whether to go into general practice or medicine, and I thought that I'd gone along the road of doing a couple of quite good house jobs, so I thought I'd get in touch with chest diseases. And then got a registrar's job. I went to the London Chest Hospital first, and then to Worthing Chest Hospital on the south coast, which was a very pleasant area to work in, travelling between hospitals. And I was married at that stage, And then I was tempted because my old, the old professor of medicine at Oxford said, well, there's a registrar at the Middlesex, the registrar's job coming up, and so I applied for that and got it, which was another revolution in life because we had to find a flat in London to live in, and he was very keen on obesity, and so I did some research on obesity. It's measuring the respiratory change of obese patients.
Yes.
Came to the conclusion that the usual interpretation of obesity was quite wrong. And I did some more clinical work there, and at the end of the 3 years I wanted to go to America to extend my metabolic work.
Yes.
And didn't get that scholarship, which I'm grateful for now, because I think that would have set me along a too narrow a path. But living, we had twin daughters by that time, who were born at the Middlesex, and so we were living in the middle of London with twin daughters. I thought, well, is this the life I want? Because I had to go through the senior registrar pathway, which is highly competitive, very difficult to get, not a good salary.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably have to go to an industrial town to do it. And I thought, well, do I want to take my wife and children to an industrial area again? And I thought, no. And I met somebody at the Middlesex who was thinking of going to Australia, and he introduced me to a GP who was looking for a physician and a surgeon to go to his medical clinic in Goulburn, which at that time was the largest group practice in New South Wales. It was about 12. And I was seduced by this idea of being my own man and practicing as a consultant physician, which I wasn't properly qualified for, but that thought it would be an escape from restricting atmosphere of London. But it did mean leaving my family behind and her family, so it was a bit like your stomach dropping through your boots. It was an enormous decision, and I think it must have hurt them a bit, although they were very supportive of my going.
How long were you anticipating being away when you went to Goulburn?
Well, quite indefinite. I thought I was going to settle down there.
No, but coming back to your family, you mean your...
Parents.
Your parents,
my
yeah.
Parents.
Sorry.
So yeah. I went with my wife and two daughters who were crawling at that stage as 10-pound Pommy migrants. Went on the Iberia. It took about 5 weeks,
right,
going through the tropics.
So you went as 10-pound
Pommy migrant.
Yeah. Yes.
And that was fun. We met some old friends who are now old friends, who we established rapport, and we kept in touch with the husband. His daughter was extremely bright and is now chairman of Telstra, and was involved in the bionic ear. She's done brilliantly. So we kept in touch with David. And in Goulburn, we really liked the farming community. We made good friends there, which we still keep. The medical community was a bit of a shock because I was not used to the fee-for-service system, and I had been on a salary, and the idea of actually charging patients...
Yes, for the National Health Service.
Yes. I thought the NHS, in retrospect, was a very good organisation, but the idea of economics hadn't entered my head, and most Australian doctors are brought up with the idea they must have a degree in economics to run their practices.
And they probably need to have some practice in accountancy.
Exactly, exactly. And yes. I was completely hopeless at these things. But it was a good experience. I did part consulting work and part general practice.
Yes.
But we kept driving over to Canberra because I wanted to use the library, the John Curtin School Library, which was excellent at that stage. Now it's sort of shriveled away to nothing, but I wanted to do some reading there. And I was very inspired by the idea of Canberra. It looked a beautiful place. Population...
So this is in the early 60s.
It's the early 60s, yes. I thought, well, this is an inspiring place. The population, 40,000, and there were only two physicians, and Mark Faunce was one of them. And Mark took me out to lunch at the Commonwealth Club and said, oh, I'd welcome you here. Yes, do come. When I went to the John Curtin School, I saw somebody walking down the stairs. I recognised Cedric Mims, who was a student with me at the Middlesex. was working in the microbiology department with Frank Fenner. And he said, oh yes, we'd like you to come to Canberra. So that sort of fixed it.
Did you know Frank before you...
I didn't know Frank before that, no.
Yes.
I knew Frank very well. We got to know each other very well after being there for a while.
Yes, but you knew Cedric Mims.
I knew Cedric very well.
Yes.
And then he later went off to Guy's Hospital as the chair of microbiology there with his family, and he subsequently came back to Canberra. Unfortunately, his wife died a couple of years ago. But that was another connection that made me feel, well, there are connections. I had no connections with the Australian Medical School.
So, yes.
And apart from the Oxford links in the ANU, I didn't have any. But I thought that would be a good place to put up my plate. I saw some estate agents called Honan. I think one of them was the brother of Ross Honan, who introduced me to the idea of taking a house rent in Tennyson Crescent in Forest, which is the heart of the business. It had an enormous garden of 1 acre, and the rent was 10 guineas a week. And so we grew vegetables and fed the family. At the end of the Goulburn people thought I'd starve, you know, going right out in, without any connections. But we grew our own vegetables. The first year I had a check back from the income tax department because I had no taxable income. But what helped me was putting my plate up in Civic in the rooms of John Lodge, who was a well-known Canberra ophthalmologist, and said, please use my veranda as your consulting room. Make use of my secretary in telephone without charge. And he'd done that with a lot of people starting off in Canberra. And that's what made it possible. And then I took on rooms further down the corridor that belonged to a psychiatrist. About that time, a surgeon had come to Canberra, Alistair Robson, and we shared rooms together.
Yes, and that was when the hospital was on the site where the National Museum now is.
That's right, and
yes.
We were really fond of that place. And it used to irritate me that Alistair could earn in one afternoon what it took me a week to earn, because as a physician in those days, a lot of your work was pro bono, because you couldn't charge colleagues and families, you couldn't charge nurses or clergy. So half of your work was pro bono. And Alistair could go and operate and earn my salary for a week in an afternoon. So I suppose that was envy, I suppose, from the economics point of view. But it was good times. I didn't seem to worry about existence. Our income gradually crept up.
But you just lived within your means and comfortably as long
right.
as you did that.
And I think,
anyway.
Happily, and yes. I think that is one of the Aristotle's point about happiness. It's not necessarily related to wealth and possessions. It's a lot to do with relationships.
Yes.
How you feel about things.
And by this time you were starting to add to your family, were you?
Yes. We were absolutely mad, and I think... we had another daughter in Goulburn. We've got 4 daughters and 1 son.
So your third daughter came in Goulburn?
Yes.
Yes.
Right, so she was the first Australian. We hadn't really thought seriously about contraception, at least I had, but very careless. And so my wife had yet another daughter when we came to Canberra, and her mother wrote a very acerbic letter to me saying what a selfish job I was, you know, with hardly visible means of support. And then finally we had a son. My wife, with whom I got an enormous admiration, she came out here without any family support, raised 5 children under 7.
Yes.
For my wife,
that's
got great admiration for.
Yes,
she came,
cut
off her family ties, came up and raised 5 children under 7.
Yeah.
And one thing I'm very happy from the health point of view, they're all breastfed up to 9 months, and all our grandchildren similarly have been breastfed.
Yes.
And I think that's very good for the immune system.
about the time you started coming to ANU as a visitor from Goulburn, you probably, maybe you hadn't noticed, but they were in fact installing an undergraduate component to the university.
Right, yes.
And that was in 1960, I think. So
yes.
There was, presumably, in that 5 or 6 years while you were working as a practitioner in Canberra, the fact of university students suddenly becoming a presence in the city.
And I saw a number of them, and they were very fond of young people. I think they're terrific. And in fact, my practice had got pretty well established, was at least paying for itself and sort of building up a bit of capital. But I saw this advertisement in the Canberra Times for the director of the University Health Service. And the advertisement itself appealed to me because it said the university felt that the health of students was of great importance, both to their personal development and their academic performance. And they were advertising for a director of the health service, preferably of consultant status, who would come and, as it were, establish a health service. And I thought, well, that's just the sort of thing I'd like, because in practice as a physician, you see a lot of end-stage disease, which you can do very little about. And I thought already that prevention was better than cure, and that being able to see young people, it might be that was the stage when you needed to introduce ideas of lifestyle which would not lead eventually to disease. A good example of that being vindicated now is that there is a pandemic of what's called the metabolic syndrome. That is obesity, type 2 diabetes and associated cardiovascular disease. And that accounts for 45% of all hospital admissions. I thought, you know, putting funding into end-stage disease is a very short-sighted approach.
Yes.
One should put investment into the early stages. Now, it's very difficult to do that in private practice because you do yourself out of the job.
Yes.
If you're successful, people don't come and see you.
That's right.
And you can't make a living.
You're anticipating it,
exactly.
Yes.
And that's why I felt the security of an income at the ANU would be very attractive, and the terms of my appointment was that I was to be paid at the same level as a professor in the School of General Studies, with similar rights to study leave and long service leave as they occurred, which appealed to me because I'd still retain my interest in research and so on. I remember at the interview, which I think Hugh Enor was the chair of the interview committee, Ralph Reeder, who'd just recently arrived as director of the Heart Foundation, Seth Gibbs, who was a psychologist, and Pat Pentany were on the committee. I remember Ralph saying, part of the conditions were that I was allowed to gain 10% of my income by private practice, so I could continue in a limited extent with my consulting medicine, which I was enjoying. And Ralph said, if that condition were not there, would you still want the job? And I said yes.
Yes.
And I think that might have made a difference.
Yes. You could give your whole concentration to the to the job. Yes.
And I remember, it's funny what I can remember back to these things. I think Seth Gibb said, how would you go about thinking about students? I said, well, a lot of it's common sense. He said, there's a lot of things that aren't common sense. You think they're common sense, but they're not. But it was quite a genial interview, really, and I was very delighted when I got the job, although it was, again, a major change in my life. It was like leaping onto the boat to come to Australia, leaping out of a reasonably well-established private practice into an unknown. My parents, of course, were overjoyed knowing how bad I was with money. Got a paid job. And I think Anne was pleased as well.
Yes. Good.
And as we had a wonderful estate in Tennyson Crescent, little house, three-bedroom house with a garden.
Whereabouts was this?
10 Tennyson Crescent.
Oh, in the same place that you had rented?
That's right. Yes, that's right. Since been sold for $1.3 million. And the house has been turned into a mansion. All the fruit trees have been chopped down and they've got a tennis court in them. So we decided, while I was still in private practice, we decided we'd better go to get our own house. And we bought one in Hughes, a spec-built house, where we've lived for the last 45 years.
So that approximately coincided with your coming to ANU, did it?
Just the year before, actually.
Yes.
So we thought my colleague, surgeon colleague, wanted to move into some swish rooms. I thought, well, my primary duty is to the family. I must get a house first without dinner before doing that. So I got the house first, and then say a new job came up.
Yes.
So it fitted in really quite well.
Yes.
And Hughes was within cycling distance of the university.
Yes.
Which enjoyed
Well, it's a good bike ride.
It is, 10K about.
Yes.
It's coming back at night, it's a bit...
Yes, that's right. So you've remained in that house nearly for getting on towards 50 years now.
Yes, 45 years.
You're living there still in the house, and
not
the children David. Have all departed.
All,
have they?
Almost an empty nest. David's still there, lives in the granny flat that we built for Anne's mother. But the reason we don't want to move is that we've got a view of the bush at the back, looking out at trees.
Yes.
And we, at an age when a lot of people think of downsizing and moving into a unit, and we think. We just miss the bush. We'd feel trapped. So as long as we're both able to prop each other up in our decrepitude, we'd rather stay there.
Now, Anne, as you said, was a nurse in England. When you came here, she was busy having children from the side of things. Did she continue at all later in life, any career?
She did, yes. She decided, she's a great reader, and decided she wanted to be a librarian. So she went to the Cambridge University, CCE, it was then, and got a degree in librarianship. Did it part-time. We sent three of our children to the AME school, which is the Association of Modern Education, formed by a group of slightly eccentric people, including Peter Herbst and one or two other people. A nice open education, which I was really, having been through the traditional system, was not happy about. But it concentrated on the full development of the child. I felt our children at that stage needed a bit of discipline in terms of their learning, which wasn't there. In fact, we were very disappointed by the education system in Canberra as a whole. We didn't think it was up to much compared with the English system. But there we are.
But they went through it. Your children all went
the three
through
youngest ones.
The ACT education.
Yes.
Or the
AME. They went Hughes Primary School. They went to, which was an excellent school.
Yes. And then they went on to AME in each case, didn't they?
Two of them went to SWAL.
School Without Walls.
School Without Walls. Yes. And I remember that Dick Johnson.
Yes.
He was quite in favour of School Without Walls. And one of our youngest daughter, Sophie. We wanted her to go to the university, and he said, well, she's been to School Without Walls, that's not a bad introduction, why don't you reapply for the ANU? And unfortunately she'd fell for a disreputable character in Sydney, and she said, no, I don't want to have anything to do with that. So she went down to Sydney.
I see.
And our two older daughters, that's Jo and Lucy, Jo went into teaching. She did a teaching diploma in Adelaide and got involved with Aboriginal education, and Lucy did nursing at Prince of Wales Hospital and is now living in Dubbo where she's working in palliative care. So neither of them have chosen a profession which is particularly well paid. I was hoping that our children would be able to support us in our old age.
And what about your son?
My son is working, he got a degree in health education at the University of Canberra, and like me, he's lazy, and he's now working as a carer, which is a very hard job, grossly underpaid, and he hasn't managed to cut the umbilical cord, so he's living at home.
Yes.
which is a pity, I think. But there we are.
So, and the fourth daughter would...
Oh, Felicity. Yes, she went to Narrabundah College, which was very good, did well in art.
Yes.
But none of them have been particularly outstanding from the academic point of view.
Yes.
And she's now working as an activities officer in Brindabella Gardens.
Right.
In other words, she looks after the old ladies.
So it's community care. Two of your children have been, and three have been in nursing.
Right.
Which is a pretty good contribution to their society, I would say.
Well, I think it's better than being a stockbroker, I suppose. Cigarette salesman. Or a lawyer. But it doesn't earn very much.
No, that's true.
They are at least self-supporting, and that's nice.
Yes. Now, Brian, about the health service, which I misnamed before, the medical service, the health service. I remember you once telling me we should think as much about ILTH as we do about
health. That's right.
The health service, so you got that established and rolling, and can you tell me what it was like to be, as it were, looking almost entirely at youngsters and the special needs they have?
Yes. First of all, I might say that when I came to university, it was like joining a family, because the administrators were very friendly and helpful. There's Colin Plowman, David Hodgkin, Ross Honan, who were all very helpful, and I could, you know, I could drop in any time and talk about finances or what I needed for equipment. And particularly Sir John Crawford, I had a very good relationship with him, and he was very supportive. So from that point of view, it was like joining a family, particularly with the Oxford connections in the John Curtin School. And the colleges were very good. And I was made a fellow, visiting fellow of Bruce Hall, with Bill Packard, so that gave me a contact with the students that way. So for the first time, I felt I was part of an extended family in a way, which was very pleasant.
Yes.
The health service itself, I think it was Pat Pentany who said that one of my duties was to examine every student. Careful notes and see what happened. And I, a bit like the army pulling, and I thought, that's totally impractical. I mean, how can I spend my time examining 2,000 healthy students? And I decided not to obey that instruction. The other negative thing about the appointment was that I was given rooms at the top of the Copeland building, which was, you know, the top floor of the Copeland building, because the counselling service had been established there with Margaret Evans. And I thought, that's an excellent idea to be in proximity to the counselling service, that's fine. But what about students with sprained ankles and broken legs and going upstairs? And I wasn't self-assertive enough to say, no, that you can't have a medical facility on the fourth floor, third floor.
Yes.
I mean, I was a bit nervous in those days, and I wasn't willing to put my foot down. If I had put my foot down and say, look, it's totally impractical, I think I would have got somewhere else. But I didn't like the idea of not being close to the counselling service, because I think that was a very good arrangement. So I think that's one of the negative decisions I made. The positive decisions I made was that I did need some help. I couldn't be my own secretary, so we had to get an excellent secretary. And I thought, well, we have to have a nurse, because I can't do all the dressings and things. I'd known Pat Sorby from my time at the Campbell Hospital, and thought of her as a highly competent nursing sister, and also with a good attitude to young people. And at that stage, Pat had moved down to Sydney. I just wrote to her and said, look, there is a job for as a nurse here. Would you like to take it on? And she took it on.
Mm.
As you know, Pat was a dynamo.
Yes.
So we established, I thought, well, the only way to run a health service is to have a team. Now, you've got to have a secretary and a nurse. Practice nurse is essential. And eventually, of course, it was nice to get an assistant. Margaret Warner applied for the job. Did you know Margaret?
No, I didn't. No.
Oh, she's wonderfully... She'd been in general practice in Canberra, and wonderfully down-to-earth, warm-hearted person.
So she came as an assistant nurse.
Part-time assistant, doctor.
Yeah, a doctor, yeah.
And that was very good in dealing with female students, of course, because that was the era when the idea of the pill was around,
yes.
And there was very strong ethical. I was still a conservative about it, and I thought, well, you know, I shouldn't be in the business students. And Margaret was very good at providing other forms of contraception, and was also good at having heart-to-heart talks to people. And she wasn't, a bit like me, she wasn't very tolerant of neurosis. You know, she was very down to earth and used to talk to students in a very motherly sort of way. And she was a great asset. And then we had this problem of students with sports injuries for rehabilitation, and the hospital system was hopeless. They'd have to join the queue of patients for physiotherapy. So we decided to appoint a physiotherapist. All this was supported by the administration, very good of them. So we had Trish Levick. Trish was the wife of Bill Levick,
right,
who worked in the John Curtin School. And she was there not only to treat injuries, but to teach students how to lift things and how to avoid injury as well as treating it. And she came in very useful later on when we had this so-called RSI epidemic. I prefer to call it the shoulder arm syndrome.
Yes.
It wasn't just repetitive.
Yes.
Remember the days when computer came?
That's right.
We had queues of people coming up saying, oh, I've got... So Trish started a program of exercises for shoulders and things.
Start,
it was
yeah.
a major crisis for the university because so many people were going off with this syndrome, and a lot of people thought it was due to neurosis and hysteria.
Yes.
Which I think certainly there was the epidemic nature of things, but there's also a very definite physical problem, which Trish was very good at.
Yes. Now, was the health service designed to also provide health service for staff in the university?
Well, the terms of my appointment were that certainly provide emergency care and also occupational health issues.
Right.
And one of the major occupational health issues was overseas travel. So we established a traveller's clinic in the health service where people get their inoculations, anti-malarial prescriptions, and advice about if they're going to the middle of New Guinea, what sort of things that they need, and so on. So that was an interesting development. There was one tragedy in which a PhD student, I think a Japanese student, went to Manus, I think, Ireland, and died of malaria. Of course, when this happens, there's a great kerfuffle on who's responsible and so on. Ian Ross wrote me a letter about duty of care and all that, and one of the results was that I got together with Maureen Barnett to produce a booklet on health in the tropics, which was given to anybody who was going overseas to make sure they were properly inoculated and so on. So that was one important aspect of occupational health and safety that I think was potentially quite useful. Particularly, and a lot of graduate students, as you know, went over as well as the staff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I did treat staff in that way. And a few staff came to see me under the counter, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing Doug Coombs on a few occasions. That was really an excuse for drinking cups of coffee and having a chat about life in general.
Yes,
and
yes.
A great admiration for Duggett.
Yes.
He had a very broad view of society. And I don't know whether this should be recorded, but...
I won't.
I remember, well, you can if you like. I mean, we used to talk about the state of the world and saying those were the days when the human impacts on the biosphere were becoming apparent in terms of climate change.
Yes.
I said, would he consider putting on a symposium at the ANU to rename the human species Homo stupidus? And quick as a flash, Nugget said, that's quite wrong, it should be Homo bloody stupidus. And he was quite a character, Nugget.
Yes.
Later on, he was very interested in Aboriginal health and She met my daughter when she was working in the outback as a teacher. So there were, and Sir John Crawford used to pop in and see me. And it was very nice to have these contacts, even though officially I wasn't to see staff.
Two things I wanted to ask you as general questions. One is how your practice of medicine, as it were, in the health service might have changed over the years as the student population has changed. And after that, to ask you about your general impressions about the university as a institution, as it were, as whether it's been kindly or whether it's done well as a university. Yes. But we'll come to that in a moment. First of all, about the health service.
Well, I think it changed a bit over the years. I mean, I kept my major sea change in moving from consultant medicine was that I was got more interested in health than in ill. And I thought there's so much more to be done in the preventive field, which you could do during a standard consultation. In other words, I was a great believer in masterly inactivity as far as treatment was concerned. But there's a lot of conditions which you can give advice on the spot about nutrition and exercise and so on. I became a bit notorious by prescribing a run round the oval for people who were a bit stressed out. But nevertheless, one was sort of drawn into the medical model a bit by having to prescribe. If people were acutely ill, you had to give them something, an antibiotic or something, because the students, on the whole, are pretty time-stressed. Mm-hmm. So I had to have some medical practice introduced into it. I also managed to run a few programs which were on the lines of health surveys. I did a student health survey with Malcolm White, who was Professor of Clinical Science, and Ralph Rieder, and we got 100 students as a sample. I think we got about a 90% response to our, we had a random sample. We did the usual things, physical examination, blood pressure, blood cholesterol, and so on. The results were remarkably good. I mean, I think we picked up one student who had hypertension, which we hadn't known before, but otherwise the general state of health was excellent. And I think I wrote that up somewhere. And Ralph and Malcolm were very supportive, because Ralph was very interested in the prevention of heart disease. There was a coronary artery epidemic at that stage. Mm. The other thing I developed was what we called a wellness resource centre, which was located in the old army drill hall, and I managed to get some equipment together, a bicycle ergometer and monitoring equipment for the heart, and was able to measure people's fitness, students' fitness, and this was often a good baseline for training. For example, people doing running or playing sports, they could have their initial fitness measured and afterwards. Then there was a group, the first Australian Himalaya expedition was started by a group of ANU students, did a general check of their health and put them on the cycloergometer and gave them advice. They were planning on the ascent of Dunagiri, which is pretty high.
Yes.
And so they had to have advice about adaptation to changing oxygen saturation and so on. And they wanted me to go with them, but I've got no head for heights. And, but there was a man working with me as a part-time medic, Mark Podkolinski, and he went with them. Two people that stand out in my mind, one was Tim McCartney Snape, who eventually walked up to the top of Everest in a pair of gym shoes from the Bay of Bengal to the top of Everest without oxygen.
Did he?
Which was an absolutely incredible feat. And Lincoln Hall, which everybody's known about now, he lost a few digits, frostbite on the Dunagiri trip, and also subsequently he was a glutton for punishment. Very nice chap, Lincoln. And I think he's still climbing and instructing people how to climb. Mm-hmm. Another of the team Andrew Blakers is now a professor of sustainability science at the ANU. He was one of the group. I think another chap, was it Ken Baldwin? Anyway, they've all done very well, those youngsters. And it was very nice to have a wellness centre where one could do these studies. I also did a study of, this was a purely questionnaire study on older students over 50. That was purely a questionnaire about their health, and they came out very healthy. You know, probably better than the average population if they'd taken the trouble to do a late degree. Were healthy in other ways, which was very encouraging.
Yes. And I suppose because of your emphasis on preventative medicine and of the importance of the healthy mind in the healthy body, the interaction with the counselling service must have been important.
It was very important, yes. I used to do a few relaxation classes as well for students who were stressed about exams. Certainly referred quite a number to the counselling service, and it was a reciprocal arrangement. They used to refer people back. I did occasionally need to send people to psychiatrists, and that was why it was useful to have on the campus Professor Henderson, who ran the NH and MRC social psychiatry unit, and he was very helpful in seeing people with psychiatric illness. Margaret and I had a good joking relationship and used to be able to exchange views about things. One of the things that did disturb me, and which disturbs every medical practitioner, was this question of confidentiality. Academics used to like to have notes about students' health if it interfered with their late essays or exams. Mm. And I used to be very vague about it, and they wanted to know the diagnosis, and I didn't think really it was their business to know the diagnosis. And so I had a few fights over that.
Yes.
And I can see it's become part of the routine now that you've got to have a doctor's certificate with diagnosis before you can get any mercy from the system, which I think is a pity, because after all, students are adults, they're not children at school. I mean, it's in their interest to do their best. That was just a slight niggling bit. I do remember participating in one or two conferences which were relevant to practice. One was Professor Basham gave an international conference on traditional Asian medicine, which involved a discussion of Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and so on, and that was really very entertaining and very, very interesting insights in the Eastern ways of looking at health.
Were there any attempts to interfere with the direction of health issues in the campus and your part or Margaret Evans's part in them?
I can't remember. There may have been some undercurrents, which, I mean, for example, not everybody agreed with my recommendation that everybody should have a bit of exercise.
Yes.
It's a bit of resistance to them. But on the positive note, Sir John Crawford was worried, this was in the 1970s, I suppose, about drugs, because there was a great media thing in that every university student is on pot and taking all these illicit drugs. And he said, look, I want you to find out about this. He gave me 6 weeks' lead to go around the world, and this was the result report. I showed it to a colleague of mine who's currently interested in drug taking, and he said, it's absolutely up to date with today's thinking. So I went to Europe and America and got some great insights about what they were doing with drug abuse. Came back with the idea that it hasn't really changed, that the most dangerous drugs are alcohol and nicotine in terms of mortality rates. As far as the ANU is concerned, I was never, hardly ever encountered a student who was involved with drugs. There were a lot on pot, admittedly, but there were no high flyers on heroin or anything. So I was able to reassure the council that, in my opinion, it wasn't a big problem. I wanted to Pat Warren, who was the statistician, said I should have published it, but Crawford put the kibosh, said it was a confidential document.
Right.
And in a way, I'm sorry I didn't publish it, because I read it myself again, and I think it sounds quite reasonable.
Yes.
And that things haven't changed all that much in the last 30 years.
Yes. But
that was another of the ventures that I was involved in. And also going to meetings of the Student Health Association, both here and when I was on leave in Britain, to communicate with colleagues, because my philosophy was not shared by most medical practitioners in Canberra.
Is that right? Yes.
In fact, when I was appointed, I had this AMA hostility. You know, here's a chap on a salary, and it's the thin end of the wedge of socialised medicine. And they wanted to make sure that I wasn't pinching their patients. So I had to face up to them and managed to assuage them on that point. I think they thought, well, this is the job of general practitioners. They should get involved in looking after students' health. And I took the view that GPs couldn't really spare the time to do listening, because that's the most important part of the consultation, is listening. So that brought me to the point where the university said, look, we're costing too much money and you'll have to go into Medicare. So they introduced the Medicare system of charging patients, which I suppose it was fair enough in terms of the university making some money.
Yes, yes.
But it did tend to shift the emphasis from health to disease again.
Yes, you know, that,
and I believe the present health service is run more like a medical service. And I think it's more or less self-sustaining, but they see everybody,
yes,
their staff, students and people from outside.
Yes.
I think they've retained some of the philosophy of this, and they have a physiotherapist and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Those changes, I think, are inevitable in the face of financial constraints on the university.
Well, in thinking about that, what was your feeling about the university more generally? I mean, was it doing well? Was it? We know now that it seems to have done very well at,
yes,
this point in terms of its academic records,
yep,
and its sort of research that's being done and the extent of citation of those.
Yes.
Was there a change? Did you perceive any change as a lay person, a lay scientist in the university over the,
yes,
20, 30 years?
I think I accepted the fact that there was a sort of apartheid between the Institute of Advanced Studies concerned with research and the School of General Studies, which was mostly concerned with teaching. Even though there was a good overlap, a lot of teachers, for example, were involved in research, but very few research workers were involved in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that was unfair, that there should be a different scale of salaries and conditions. So that's one thing that puzzled me a little bit. I could understand the history, that initially it was a research university, but my concept is of a university is that it should be an institution of learning. I think, as you say, Ian Chubb pushed the barrow of excellence in research, and I think Ian Young, is it?
Ian Young,
The new Vice Chancellor is blowing the trumpet of wanting everybody to be involved in research. Now, I think that's a pity in a way, because a lot of research workers run out of steam when they reach their 40s and so on. What do they do after that? I mean, there's some that go on forever, like Jack Eccles, for example. I think the function, a university, if it's being called a university rather than a technical, should be much concerned with teaching. And that's what worries me about this present, I think I'd call it hubris, of saying we're the best university in Australia and want to have on the league table, we want to be up in the top 10 internationally, that's fine. But from the students' point of view, they may be missing out something. I mean, research mostly consists in applying for research grants. As one of my colleagues in American college, Link Day, in demography, said in America about 3/4 of an academic's time is spent applying for research grants. I think from researchers' point of view, they should teach. I don't think they should be tied to the laboratory bench.
Mm.
They're creative people, and I think they should transmit some of this information to students. And one of the things that I deplore is the undermining of languages and classics. I was very sad when Beryl Rawson had to go finally. Beryl Rawson,
Beryl
who was
Rawson,
head of the
classics
after Dick Johnson. And I think any civilized university should teach the classics, because my view is that we've still a lot to learn from the ancient Greeks. I mean, Aristotle and Socrates were still currency.
Yes.
And if we learnt more from them about ethics and so on, you know, morality and values, those are very important things which are missing in modern society. And I think any university worth its salt should teach ethics.
Yes.
And philosophy. I think the problem of today's world is fragmentation of knowledge. People stick to their own little silos and super specialization. I mean, in medicine, this was the case. I had to be a general physician when I was here because you had to do everything. There were only two other physicians. But now, if you do medicine, you've got to specialize to make a living. You've got to be involved with orthopedics or gastroenterology or cardiology, and you lose sight of the whole. And that is what the word health is derived from. It's the old English health, meaning whole. And the more specialised you get, the less opportunity you have to see the big picture. And I've noticed that in a lot of ANU seminars that are given, that there's a lot of tunnel vision. It won't think laterally very much. And the system of research and grants, as a layman, I think is knowing more and more about less and less. I find that I know less and less about more and more. But super specialised, and who is there? Who is left to integrate? And I think that's why the School of Environmental Studies and what Stephen Boyden is doing is to try and integrate. Interdisciplinary teaching is vital, really, for the future of the country. So I would debate with Ian Young about that. I think it's super to have a university, and I've got a very high regard for the ANU and affection for it. I wish it would readopt a more civilised approach to learning and teaching.
Yes. Do you have a feel, Brian, for the pressures that students are under in terms of the amount of work they do
and
the need to support themselves?
Yeah. I think they're on a treadmill because I think when I was very fortunate to go through university without having to pay anything. Mm. But to finish your university career with $100,000 debt around your neck is no way to look forward to. And I think there is an enormous pressure to get jobs, you know, part-time jobs and a full-time study don't mix. I don't think it brings out the best. You've got to introduce some time for leisure and thinking.
Yes.
I think, as Bertrand Russell said, that leisure is the final end of civilization. You know, that you've got to be able to stand back as a human being and think for yourself. With this treadmill of deadlines for assignments and exams and achievements and jobs, I think we live in a world that's become far too cluttered with information and what we call progress.
Well, as Giles Pickford said to me in one of these interviews, he said, a university student should have the opportunity to at least appear before a police court on at least three occasions.
Yes, that's great. I think that's a very nice thing. Coming back to John Crawford, there was a great deal of student unrest going on at the time of Vietnam.
That's right.
Which I thoroughly supported. I mean, I didn't have the courage to join in the demonstrations, but there was sort of almost riotous behaviour on the campus, and a lot of administrators would have shut down the gates and so on. John Crawford asked the student leaders to come up to the council chamber, give them cups of tea, and to talk about it. And that completely defused the situation. They could see that he was on their side, basically. He didn't want he doesn't want studies to be disrupted or anything, but I think he said that he agreed with their findings. And in other words, instead of it, them and us, it was a general feeling that the university's in this together.
We're in this together.
Yes.
That's right. Yes.
And I think there was a great thread of idealism going through the student body in those days.
Yes.
Which is to be applauded.
Yes.
And the media, of course, look on it as, you know, riotous
behaviour,
undisciplined adolescence. So things have changed in that direction. I think there's less rioting in the street.
Become more polarised again, probably. Yes. And talking about idealism, I mean, your most recent activities, Brian, I think a lot of people would say betoken your idealism and the opportunity you now have to, in a way, practice and to think about and to write about the things, the big issues that you are interested in.
Yes, well, I'd like to describe my first sea change was from ill to health, as it were, and cure to prevention. My other sea change was really more on the cusp of retiring and onwards, was to convert my interest in internal medicine to external medicine. In other words, the health of the planet. Seems a bit pretentious, but it seemed to me that you cannot have a healthy population if we're destroying the planet, our own habitat. I agree with Kevin Rudd saying this is a major moral challenge of our time is climate change. Not only climate change, but destruction of the biosphere in terms of logging, pollution, with all sorts of nasty pollutants, which I'm sure are contributing to the rise in cancer in the society. What Nature and Society Forum is doing, you know, the healthy people on a healthy planet, is a pretty good aim.
Yes, it's the old motto of think locally and act globally.
Yes.
Yes. Sorry, act globally, act locally and think globally.
Yep. Yes, and Frank actually changed that to think and act locally and globally.
Yes.
You've got to act globally as well as locally. And that's what's missing at the moment. That's why I think that Australia is backward in its responsibilities towards the environment. And this bickering that goes on about carbon tax is a flea bite. I mean, at least if the carbon tax come in, it's token recognition of the fact that we realise that we're polluting the planet beyond safe means and that we've reached a tipping point. This has got to be widely recognised. A lot of young people recognise it. Their primary school kids know about it. Old people don't, and my generation do, because they think about it. But I think when one considers children and grandchildren, it does make me worried about what's happening. The same principle applies to the environment as applies to medicine. In other words, it should be evidence-based medicine. Evidence-based environmental studies, to my mind, the most dangerous people in the community are these denialists, usually funded by fossil fuel industries, who says, no, there's no such thing as climate change, despite the evidence, which I think is overwhelming. And I think universities should have a strong voice in this. And last night I went to, was it last night or the night before? Yes, last night. At the John Curtin School, there was a very good symposium on our energy futures. And Andrew Beckers was talking to other people, I can't remember the name of, but I was amazed at the number of courses that students now have on climate and sustainability. I think it's wonderful.
Yes.
I think the university needs to put that into action. In other words, it needs harassing the government and keep telling the government, being elected, to be responsible for Australia, and they should jolly well do something about changing policies. And as we said earlier, both sides of Parliament have virtually identical views about these things, and we're gradually sliding backwards rather than going forwards.
It's easier to do nothing than to
absolutely
interact.
It is. And as Andrew Blecker said last night, that in 50 years' time, or less than by 2050, availability of renewable energy would be such as it would compete economically with coal. I'm a member of the Strategic Council of the Climate Institute, and they've calculated that the introduction of renewable energy would bring at least 50,000 jobs.
Right.
We just have to phase out coal. It's a dangerous substance. The way I look at it is that burning fossil fuels is cashing in on solar energy capital, and we need to change that to using solar currency.
Yes, using it.
And that goes right to house design and building design and so on. And developers are very backwards about this.
Yeah.
The other thing that people shy away from is the any discussion of population control. And the whole issue of environmental impact is a simple equation. Environmental impact equals population times resource use. And there have been several calculations. I think Tony McMichael is one of the people that's done it, that we need at least two or three planets if everybody's going to move out up to the standard of living that we are in Australia. And yet, the moment you talk about the need for frugality or austerity, people go on strike and say, we can't do this, that and the other. And forget that one-sixth of the world has got too many resources and one-sixth of the world is near to starving. In other words, we don't recognise the global ethical responsibility. I mean, why should we use... We use about 50 times as much energy as we use for metabolism. Indian peasants use about 3 times as much. So there's a gross disproportion in energy, in resource availability. This is the paper that I wrote recently, which I was talking to Nick about the Anthropocene and its discontents. And the Anthropocene was introduced by a Nobel Prize winner, Paul Crutzen, who was a chemist.
Yes.
If you remember, he was responsible for finding the hole in the ozone layer.
Yeah.
And he went to a climate conference in 2000, and he and some of his colleagues said we're fully aware of the damage we've done to the planet and said we should rename this era the Anthropocene. Not the Holocene, it's usually called the Holocene, but so great has been the human impact footprint on the planet that is, we should talk about the Anthropocene, which really coincides with the Industrial Revolution. And we don't realise that we're using non-renewable resources, oil. We've passed peak oil. And yet people are starting to drill in the Arctic and underwater drilling, destroying forests. We're going in exactly the opposite direction. And we're the one species that seems... We're supposed to be intelligent. The one species that seems intent on committing suicide. It's the way we're going. Not many people like to think about these things, but...
No.
You know, I think one should... I lived through wartime Britain when I think Churchill was a great leader. It was either we've got to have rationing and pull together or we are invaded by the Germans. And there was a great pulling together of society, of reducing our living standards, so-called. But the health of the nation was improved. You know, children's health was better. They had basic free milk and orange juice and so on.
Yes.
And there was a sense of purpose and urgency, because either they did it or we were going to be invaded. Now, a greater problem exists at the moment. Either we do something or we must expect environmental collapse. And it's already happening in Africa. I mean, something like 13 million people in East Africa faced with starvation from drought. And yet we grumble if the price of bananas goes up. You know,
that's right.
It's pathetic. In other words, there is a parochialism about modern society in the Anthropocene which needs to be addressed. And that's why universities should not be too parochial. And I think these sort of debates should be made, you know, there should be public lectures held by the university to discuss these issues in a way which is intelligible to laypersons. I mean, so many of these climate conferences, you see very complicated graphs and equations which the average person can't take in. And I think it's up to the university to do that. And I think Ian Young could lift his sights above achieving the most excellent university in Australia to be the most useful. And yes, that would mean really looking out more to the community.
Well, is there anything that you would like to say or to ask yourself in terms of finishing this interview? Because I may have missed some issues that you would like to give voice to.
I've forgotten, yes. I'd just like to say about the Emeritus Faculty, I think it's a terrific organisation. And it really points the view that society suffers from a deficiency disease, and the deficiency is wisdom. You get wisdom from very small children and older people. Small children are not able to have a voice or articulate, but retired people, the jobs aren't on the line. They can say more or less what they say, what they like, without anybody taking any notice. But they should be able to say things with some authority. I think the older societies used to have tribal elders who would respect. I mean, the Aboriginal society relied entirely on their tribal elders for wisdom. And I hate all this talk of smartness and cleverness, because it's quite different from wisdom. I think, as Aristotle said, the beginning of wisdom is the recognition of how little we know. The other philosophical thing, which isn't very popular, is when I set for my entrance to Merton College, I did the usual biology questions, but they set a general question, and the one that sticks in my mind all this time was, discuss the value of astronomy. And they were looking for things like navigation skills and all that. And I said, the most important thing about astronomy is to teach one's own material insignificance. I mean, when you look at one of the slides I've got, which I hope Nick will make, is the Horsehead Nebula, and recognizing we're a tiny part of the universe. That's one of Aristotle's major faults, that he said man was the center of the universe. And that suited the Catholic Church, of course, but then Galileo comes along and said, no, it's not, the sun doesn't go around the earth, it's the other way around. And so the church put him in front of the Inquisition, and it took 3 centuries for them to forgive him for telling the truth.
Yes, that's right.
You know, it's extraordinary, the amount of vested interest in inertia in our society.
Yes, exactly. It takes a long time to change things. It
certainly does. I remember when Kevin Lafferty was appointed head of the John Curtin School, he said it's a bit like turning the Queen Mary. It takes such a long time to change things. Unless you get a crisis like a war, but then it's too late. Yeah. You've got to be able to change the direction. It's a bit like the Titanic, really.
Yes.
It's a good example of greed and hubris. You know, they wanted to cross the Atlantic as fast as possible. The investors in the Titanic were anxious to win the race, and the master of the ship had all these information about it being unsinkable, and yet the icebergs ahead didn't take any notice.
Yes, didn't think about that.
So
yes,
the world's a bit in the situation of the Titanic.
Good, well, thank you, Brian, for coming along and
pleasure
telling us about your time in both in preparing to go to ANU and then getting to ANU, and now as a closing stages, but a new period of opportunity for you, which you're obviously putting to best effect.
Thank you very much. I might say that I really love my time at the ANU, and I think it's a terrific university. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful campus, and I think students are very lucky to be in it.
Hear, hear.
In this interview, we heard from Brian Furness, previously Foundation Director of the ANU Health Service and now an activist in environmental health at local and global levels. The interview is part of Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program and was recorded in September 2011 at the Faculty Office. Peter Stewart was the interviewer and audio producer.